This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another fun episode of Pop Goes the Classics, Disney edition, here in the Place to Be Nation Pop Feed. I am one of your co-hosts, Andy Acton. Thank you for joining us tonight. Tonight we're going to going through a bunch of anthology films that featured many shorts, kind of similar to what we did on the last episode with Saludos Amigos and Three Caballeros. We will be back to reviewing full-length animated features like regular you would expect on our next episode. So just enjoy as we talk about a lot of these shorts, which if you cannot find the movies whole on Disney Plus, you can find a lot of the shorts, especially the first one we're going to talk about. But let me bring in the rest of the crew. Joining me as well here is Miss Miranda Berthold. Miranda, how are you?
I am alive.
Yes, that's always a plus.
Right. I can verbalize that I am alive, and therefore I'm doing what you'd say. Okay.
Yes, that's one of the requirements for being on a podcast. You have to be living.
I don't know. Do you have a good voice?
Oh, that's true.
So you have to be non-living and have a great voice, and I'd probably hire you.
All right, there you go. Box checked. All right, also joining us, the other part of our trio, Steve Riddle. Steve, how are you?
Hey, guys, I'm doing good.
All right. How are things in your neck of the woods over in Arizona?
Not too bad. The heat's starting to go down finally. It's getting a little... You know, we're now seeing a, you know, high 80s, low 90s here, as opposed to, you know, 110 degree days.
Ah, yeah. Well, in the Northeast, it's really becoming fall. We're just getting out of that period where it's like, I'm going to be cold one day, I'm going to be hot one day, I'm going to be cold one day, I'm going to be hot one day. You know, you don't know what you should be wearing when you walk out the door. So luckily now it's starting to get into the cold and leaves are falling and rainy, but you know, it's kind of like, I hate the cold as I mentioned quite well on the last episode, but it's also like, I just want the weather to pick which way it's going to be. This indecision kills me.
It is 48 degrees here.
Oh, it's 53. Mm-hmm. All right. So, tonight we're going to talk about, four movies. First of which is Make My Music, released in 1946. This was the third package film. A lot of this had to do with the war going on and resources not being available and concentrating, separating your team, the animated teams to just work on shorts, which they feel they could have compiled and put into a theater, which is what they did. And actually, this movie is not on Disney Plus, which is usually where we go for watches, but a lot of these shorts are on there. So if you look up the individual pieces, like I said earlier, that you will be able to find them. So the first of the film segments is The Martins and the Coys, which is the Kingsmen, who was a popular radio vocal group at the time. They sang a story of the Hatfields and McCoys and where the mountains broken up when two young people from Eastside inadvertently fall in love. It was censored later on in the home video release of it due to the objection of film's depiction of gun use. But that is actually not on the version that we watched. So then we have Blue Bayou, which a segment that featured animation originally intended for Fantasia using Claude Debussy's musical composition Claire de Lune from the suite Bergamesque, it featured two egrets flying through the Everglades on a moonlit night. However, by the time Making My Music was released, the song was replaced by Blue Bayou, performed by the Ken Darby Singers, and the original version of the segment, though, still survives. I thought this was fine. It was like a very elegant and simple animated short. The reflection of the moonlight in the water with the ripples and the egrets flying along looked like it heavily influenced New Orleans Square at Disneyland. Miranda, what do you think of Blue Bayou?
I think Blue Bayou would have been a great addition to Fantasia, but I can understand why they didn't have any more shorts in Fantasia, to be honest with you. They do have a Blue Bayou in Disneyland. Isn't it a restaurant?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. So they do. They have like a Blue Bayou area in Disneyland. But overall, I thought that it was really cute. I thought it could have gone well into Fantasia, and I see why it was intended for that. Did you guys see both versions with both like the two different songs? No, okay.
I don't think I have. Yeah, I've only seen.
Okay, I hadn't either, and so that was what I was going to say. Is I would like to see what the original was. Because apparently the original song is really what was intended. And if I thought it was with the second song, I wonder how I'd feel hearing the Claude's version there.
Yeah. Steve, what did you think of Blue Bayou?
It was a fine segment. Like the guy, I've never seen the... the version of this I watched was the DVD version. So I've probably never seen the original one as well. But you know, it was fine for what it was. That's pretty much all I could say. It was fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of a lot of these shorts are that's where we're going to go. I mean, you know, they are what they are. I mean, it was part of the, you know, you could definitely see they didn't want this this great animation to go to waste. So they, you know, repurposed it, which, you know, was fine. It's a nice way to start off. So then we got our next short is called All the Cats Join In, which is two sections. It's comprised of with Benny Goodman and his orchestra contributed to. Their music is played over visuals drawn by an animator's pencil as the action occurred. The scene portrayed teens in the 1940s being swept away by popular music. And it actually had featured some mild female nudity, which had been edited out on some versions. So I thought it was very period accurate. You know, the teenage girl wearing a towel, and you can kind of see her bloomers. You know, I really like the pencil drawing no part because, you know, Daffy Duck does do it a lot on his shorts. And, you know, there were some, you know, period issues, again, that wouldn't fly today in this short. You know, the girl that was a little bit on the larger side doesn't get, you know, picked to dance with until, you know, she's slimmed down by the animation. So there's some issues there. But Steve, what did you think of this this one? This All Cats Join In.
Yeah, it was good. Like you said, definitely caught the period at of teenagers at that time pretty well. The one kind of takeaway I take from it is the little sister of the teen who's getting ready to go out on the date, and she's like getting herself all dolled up, and it's like, does she really think she's going to be able to go out with her sister? It was just, you know, it was fine enough for what it was. That's really that's so much to it. And I watched it, I almost kind of got a feeling of, it feels like more, I kind of thought the teens felt more reminiscent of the 50s, even though we weren't in the 50s yet, but maybe it was just foreshadowing what was to come.
Yeah, maybe that was the change. You know, we were changing over from like the 30s and 40s into what was going to be the, you know, that time period. Miranda, what do you think of this short, All the Cats Join In?
So I very much agree that it felt like it was more of the 50s. It was different. I don't remember seeing this before. So it was, I don't know, I found it on YouTube and I thought it was catchy, but it wasn't really like, oh, I liked that. You know, I didn't hate it, but I was like, just a horrible description, but that's how I felt.
It was a little more Warner Brothers-esque than Disney, in my opinion. It really felt like, if you showed this to somebody, they would think it would be a Warner Brothers short. Not really a Disney short, per se. Just based on the animation. And then we have a really short segment called Without You, which is a ballad of lost love sung by Andy Russell. You know, I really didn't have many notes for this. I mean, the rain on the window animation I thought was really well made. I mean, it's like one of those, it's kind of like the opening one. It's like, it's nice. It's a nice, beautifully animated sequence, but not much to it besides, you know, kind of like a little feast for your senses, if you will. You know, Steve, you have any thoughts on this Without You short segment?
No, I think you pretty much said it. It is interesting, and we'll talk about it as we go along, but because for such a and this kind of applies for the next films we'll talk, the other films we'll talk about, for such nondescript films, they went out of their way to get some pretty big names for the time period to be in these films. I mean, you got Andy Russell here, Benny Goodman, obviously Sterling Holloway will return. We'll talk about him, and we'll talk about later, like the Andrews sisters and Dinah Shore. And, you know, so this is some pretty big names for these films when they're, you know, they're not, you know, we don't think of them as major films, but at the same time, they managed to pull out some big stars for the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Miranda, do you have any thoughts on this part?
Not really. It was just a really cool little segment. I mean, some of these are what they are, just like really cool little segments and not really much more to say about them, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And then we move on to Casey at the Bat, which is a segment that features Jerry Colonna reciting a poem that is titled Casey at the Bat by Ernest Thayer, about an arrogant baseball player whose cockiness was his undoing. A few moments are exaggerated or altered as music is added. Yeah, this is a legendary story that, you know, is often performed live. I remember Tug McGraw, I seeing a video of him doing it. And then, sorry, I apologize. My dog decides to scratch himself while I'm talking. If you hear that, in a lot of caricatures of you know, different archetypes, you know, you have your heavy set, you have your dumb looking guy, you have a guy sleeping at the game. Casey is your perfect specimen, kind of an asshole, you know, not going to mince words there, cocky, and you know the way the crowd kind of turns on the umpire, kill the umpire, was very. But this is a lot of. I really enjoy this short. Miranda, what about you? What do you think of Casey at the Bat?
This is one that I did remember, and I really liked this one as well. There's actually a sequel cartoon, if I remember correctly, Casey Bats Again, and I didn't really remember that one, but I'm pretty sure you could YouTube it or something if you were interested. But I really have always enjoyed this one.
Yeah. Steve, what do you think of Casey at the Bat?
Yeah, this was definitely one of the better shorts of this film. Obviously, most people probably are familiar with the story. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, we all, you know, anyone who's a baseball fan knows, would know of baseball players that are similar to Casey, like overconfident, over arrogant, cocky, that, and, you know, they end up, you know, not being worth what they're, you know, what they think they are. Mm-hmm. And it's always funny how the you know, Casey, you know, he intentionally gets two strikes and the crowd wants to kill the umpire, even though it's Casey's own fault. It's funny, the only other version of this, of Casey at the Bat, that I really remember was, I don't know if you guys remember when Tiny Toon Adventures did their own version of it with Buster as Casey.
Oh.
It was the same thing with Buster as Casey, but instead of him striking out, he hits a home run. So obviously they changed it up a little bit, but it was definitely probably the third best short in the film, behind two other ones, which we'll get to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree with you there. You know, there was no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. So then we have another short piece that's kind of like a bridge, I guess you want to say, two silhouettes, which features two rotoscope live-action ballet dancers moving in silhouette with animated backgrounds of characters, Dinah Shore, and sung the title song. You guys have any thoughts on this interlude? I mean, it was really just you know, an interesting mix of live action animation. You know, again, it's one of those, it's nice. Nothing to really write home about.
I'd agree with that statement.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Now we move on to a story that I loved as a child, because actually my mother's side of the family is Russian and Polish, and my grandmother told me this story as a kid, and there were some other interpretations that I had seen, but this is one of my favorites, Peter and the Wolf, which is a animated dramatization of the 1936 musical composition by Sergei Prokofiev, was narrated by, you know, Sterling Holloway, Again, a perfect use of his voice. A Russian boy named Peter sets off into the forest to hunt the wolf with his animal friends, a bird named Sasha, a duck named Sonia, and a cat named Ivan. Just like in the piece, each character is represented by a specific musical accompaniment. Peter by the string quartet, Sasha by the flute, Sonia by the oboe, Ivan by the clarinet, Grandpa by the bassoon, the shooting of the hunter's gun by the kettle drums, and the evil wolf portrayed primarily by horns and cymbals. This is such a great use. The wolf is quite menacing. Sasha, Sonia and Ivan are a very ragtag group. The death of Sonia, which is, the first time, if you're watching it for the first time, it really hits you. But, you know, luckily that, what happens to Sonia in the end. The three hunters, the heavyset one, the tall one, the short one, and Peter getting extremely lucky. So, Steve, what are your thoughts on Peter and the wolf?
Yeah, this was a good segment. I think it was definitely carried by Sterling Holloway with his narration. I don't know if I've ever heard the actual musical composition. This was the only knowledge of Peter and the Wolf that I had. I thought it was kind of interesting how each character was represented by a specific instrument, and you would hear that throughout the segment, which was fun. I love how Peter, he's like this. He thinks he's gonna be this great big hunter, and he thinks he can hunt a wolf with only a pop gun. like he's really over, really confident in his abilities. But like you said, through some sheer luck, he's able to tie the wolf up, and they capture him. So good for him. But I thought it was a fun segment. Definitely one of the other highlights of this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Miranda, what do you think of Peter and the Wolf?
Peter and the Wolf is actually one of my favorites from this. I remember it being shown in other places as well. I thought it was really cute and very well done. And overall, it's one of my favorite Disney shorts of all the ones that they've done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lots of fun. And then we have another kind of interlude, which is After You've Gone, which is featured, again, Benny Goodman and the Goodman Quartet. As six anthropomorphized instruments, the piano, bass, snare, and bass drums, the cymbal and clarinet, who paraded through a musical playground. And then the next short after that, Johnny Fedora and Alice Bluebonnet, which is a story, a romantic story of two hats that fall in love in the department store window. Once Alice is sold, Johnny devoted himself to finding her again. They eventually, by pure chance, meet up again, live happily ever after, side by side. The vocals are provided by the Andrews Sisters. It was released separately on occasion. But Miranda, what do you think of the Johnny Fedora and Alice Bluebonnet short?
I didn't remember that one, to be honest with you. And then I watched it, and I thought it was really cute. Mm-hmm. I kind of like the whole concept, and I'm kind of a sucker for that, like, cheesy little sweet romance. So it kind of was done that in, or that's kind of what it is, basically, in cartoon form. And so I thought it was really cute.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Steve, what did you think of this one?
Yeah, it was a good segment. Again, pretty much a showcase for the Andrews Sisters. And, it's kind of funny that all the trials that this Fedora goes through to meet up with his love again, and they end up being together on two horses. So, nice little love story between them. So it was fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he kind of goes through the ringer, so to speak, and then they end up on horses next to each other, which is really cute. And then the final segment in the movie is the whale who wanted to sing at the Met. I remember seeing this for the first time under just a separate short called Willie the Operatic Whale. But it's a bittersweet story about a sperm whale named Willie with incredible music talent and dreams of singing grand opera. A rumor is spread through the city about an operatic whale, but is seemingly disproven. Therefore, the short-sighted impresario Teddy Toddy believes that the whale has been swallowed an opera singer and sets out to rescue his non-existent quarry. Newspapers announced that he was going to see Whitey, Willie's seagull friend, excitedly brings Willie to the newspaper, and all of his friends believe that it's a big chance, so he goes out to meet the boat and sing for Teddy Toddy. He finds them, and upon hearing Willie sing, Teddy Toddy comes to believe that Willie has swallowed not one, but three singers, due to his having three uvulae, each with a different voice range, tenor, baritone, and bass, and then chases him with a harpoon on a boat and three crewmen. Upon hearing the whale sing, the crewmen stop the submarine and delude Teddy Toddy from killing the whale as they want to continue listening to him sing, even to the point of pinning Teddy Toddy down by sitting on him. A montage then follows of what would be Willie's future career in performing opera on stage at the Met, with Teddy Toddy showing to have finally been convinced otherwise. In the end, reality strikes when Teddy Toddy succeeds in harpooning and killing Willie, but narrator explains that Willie's voice, now in a thousand, each more golden than before, will sing on in heaven. So, Steve, you probably again, one of your favorite parts of this movie, but what do you think of Willie, the operatic whale who wanted to sing at the Met?
Mammy's little baby love shortening, shortening. Mammy's little baby love shortening brick. God, that song's so catchy. But yeah, this was definitely this was my favorite segment of the film. Kind of interesting about having a whale that can sing, not only sing opera but can sing three different voice ranges for an opera. And you know, I liked how they did the little montage of him, you know, singing in the different theaters, and how he, you know, you think he's going to become this big star, but then you know, reality slaps you in the face when we find out that Teddy Toddy killed him. Definitely a major downer to this segment, which kind of sucks. But but then, you know, we get to hear him that he's, you know, he continues singing in heaven. But it was definitely a fun segment and a good one to end the film.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Miranda, what do you think of this piece?
I really don't know. Like, I feel like it was really well done and it's really good, but it's also like really sad. Like, I understand the whole concept of like, don't worry, now his voice can live on in thousands of other people, and more, and he'll sing on in heaven, but I mean, they still killed the poor whale. Yeah, I don't even know how to feel about that.
Still processing that.
Right.
No, it's fun. It's definitely a interesting dream sequence with kind of like a downer, though. I mean, well, we all know Disney's not afraid to kill off beloved characters, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. We have got, you know, Miranda's got feelings on that.
Yeah.
All right, so that's going to bring an end to Make My Music. So we're going to continue on. We're going to skip over the next movie that was released because, one, you can't find it anywhere unless it's a bootleg. And two, I don't know how we would tiptoe around Song of the South. So we're going to move on to Fun and Fancy Free, which is another anthology. This one is actually on Disney Plus. You can find it on there. It was released in 1947. It's a compilation of two stories. First, which Bongo, hosted by Jiminy Cricket and narrated by Dinah Shore. And then later on, it's Mickey and the Beanstalk, which is narrated by Edgar Bergen, which is a retelling of Jack and the Beanstalk featuring Mickey, Donald, and Goofy. But so Miranda, what are your thoughts on seeing Fun and Fancy Free for the first time and since?
I watched it as a kid, and I remember Mickey and the Beanstalk more than I do Bongo, but I do remember really enjoying it. And then watching it again, I still really liked Mickey and the Beanstalk, and then kind of like reminded me, because again, sometimes you watch these and you know you've seen them, and you remember how you felt when you watched them before. You remember liking them, but you're like, you don't really remember it, if that makes sense. And also watching something at a different point in your life has a different feel to it as well. Mm-hmm. So I remember watching it before. I remember really, really liking it. And then watching it now, I still enjoyed it, just in a different manner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Steve, what are your opening thoughts on Fun and Fancy Free?
Yeah, this was another one that I don't recall ever seeing before. Like, I might have, again, it's one of those things where I think I might have seen the Mickey and the Beanstalk in like passing, but never like no have no like full memories of it. So like some of the other films, this was the I was seeing this for the first time when I was doing my review of it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So then, you know, we get Jiminy Cricket, who returns, as well as, I believe it's Cleo, the fish from Pinocchio as well, is in the scene. But those toys are kind of miserable looking, the doll and the stuffed bear, in my opinion. So then the story is Bongo, who longs for freedom, which is, he is a circus bear. He is raised in captivity and is praised for performances, but is poorly treated once he is off stage. As such, while traveling on a circus train, his natural instincts, a.k.a. the call of the wild, urge him to break free. As soon as he escapes, he enters the forest. And a day passes before his idealistic assessment of his new living situation has been emotionally shattered, and he experiences some hard conditions. My thoughts were like, you know, was this like the same circus that Dumbo was in, it seemed like? You know, with, I don't know if Chip and Dale had been out, but thinking maybe those were the precursors, you know, and trying to sleep outside. You know, Bongo seemed to be at pampered, hadn't been, he wasn't used to it. Then we get Lockjaw, the village bear, the villain bear, I mean, trying to figure out, you know, what this, these bears are doing. Why doesn't they band together against him? Because thinking he might have been a humper. And it's almost like watching Lumberjack Games, in my opinion. Steve, what do you think of Bongo the Short as its own?
It was good. It's funny. I didn't even think about that at first, but it would have been kind of cool if we did get a little a Dumbo cameo appearance when Bongo's in the circus. That would have been kind of fun. But yeah, it was, you know, kind of interesting seeing him, you know, be in a, you know, wanting to be in the wild, and then he finally gets his wish and he realizes it's not like he had thought it would. And seeing him and Lulu Bell start to fall in love, and then he has to essentially battle Lumpjaw for her affections. And, you know, at first he doesn't realize that when she slaps him, that's a sign of affection. He thinks that she hates him all of a sudden. And then they do this, they do this whole big song and dance, you know, where they talk about how when bears are in love, they say it with a slap. And seeing like all these bears and do like a little doing a square dance is quite the sight to see. And then the final battle with him and Lumpjaw, with Lumpjaw getting swept away in the river, and then Bongo finally gets the girl. It's a good little ending to this good short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that. Yeah, sorry for saying Lockjaw. I again can't read my own notes. Miranda, what were your thoughts on Bongo?
I pretty much agree with everything that Steve said. I liked how it was done. I thought it was a very good short, very well done short. I really kind of like how it kind of opened and closed. And, you know, you even said, like, you move on and it's not exactly what you think it's going to be. It's kind of like what happened with the little penguin before. It wasn't exactly what he thought it was going to be. But eventually it does turn out completely okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so we get to another live-action sequence, which is narrated by Edgar Berman, who has his ventriloquist dummies, Charlie McCarthy and Mortimer Snerd, and they tell the tale to the child actress Luana Patton at her birthday party, with Jiminy listening in after having read an invitation shortly after the previous story ended. This is a classic tale. It's Mickey and the Beanstalk, basically, and it's a tale of Jack and the Beanstalk, where, you know, they climb up the beanstalk, and, you know, Donald, you know, is typical Donald with his lack of patience and messing with dragonflies, the humongous food, you know, and it's our first glimpse of Willy the Giant, who we actually will see at times down the line, very famously. I believe he plays the ghost of Christmas Present in Mickey's Christmas Carol later on. Mm-hmm. I love his little thing where he picks up like a lamppost and uses it like a flashlight. That's one of my favorite. And the way he's like mispronounces food. But Miranda, what are your thoughts on Mickey and the Beanstalk?
Mickey and the Beanstalk to me is a classic, very well done. I've always loved this one. I think what is also said to be true is, like, it holds up because it's just the story of Jack and the Beanstalk, essentially. And I don't know, but is this the first time that we see Goofy, Donald, and Mickey, like, together as a trio?
I was about to ask that. I think it is.
It is. I think so. I don't think they released a short with the three of them together yet.
I didn't think so either. So this is kind of the first time that we get that, and you're going to get a lot of that as the time goes on, and they turn out to be like a great little trio of friends. And again, they reuse Willy, which is really fantastic. And I mean, if you know the story of Jack and the Beanstalk, you kind of already know what happens, but you get this sense of humor that comes with the trio that we've mentioned here, and you kind of get those extra little things that like Disney would throw in. So overall, it is one of my favorite shorts. I think it's very well done. And there were some alternate versions that I don't know if they're available or how you would see them, but I think it would be cool to see how those were as well.
Okay. Steve, what are your thoughts on Mickey and the Beanstalk?
Yeah, this was I enjoyed this segment a lot. I was reading up on it, and it was saying how during this time, Disney felt that Mickey was not as popular as he once was, so they started incorporating him into these little shorts like this one. And they mentioned about how he was in Fantasia, and it also says that apparently this was supposed to be part of another film that we'll obviously talk about later. It was supposed to be with Wind of the Willows and not with Bongo, so it would have been interesting to see how that pairing would have turned out. But as a whole, I thought it was good. Like I said, you know, cool seeing Mickey, Donald, and Goofy together. Donald going cabin fever crazy when they have no more food, and the scene where he and Goofy start singing about like all the various foods they're gonna eat, and then Mickey comes and says that he sold, you know, traded the cow for magic beans, and you know, Donald flips out again, and you know, they go up to the castle, and they see the giant food, and of course you have to have a Goofy trying to chase his hat on that big jello mold, which was a trip in itself. And then they end up it's kind of funny because it's like they try to portray Willy as this gentle giant, but at the same time he also has a temper, and he ends up, you know, chasing them around and tries to, chase after them, and they end up, you know, we know how the story ends. They cut the beanstalk down and the giant falls, you know, and he falls seemingly to his death. But then in the end, we see he has survived and he's made it to the real world where he's trying to find Mickey in Hollywood, mm-hmm. which is kind of an interesting sight. But as a whole, it was a fun, you know, fun short to be coupled together with Bongo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's tremendous. It's one of those, like, I would definitely highly suggest you seek it out if you're a fan of the three of them, especially when they're together. It's a lot of fun. And I really love about the end that you mentioned, the Brown Derby, the Chinese Theater, the Trocadero. I mean, this is all, it kind of looks like, you know, the studios in Florida, you know, because they have replicas of a lot of those places. And you can definitely tell Walt had an affinity for California, you know, when he first gets out there and tries to recreate that in films quite often. So that's going to bring an end, though, to Fun and Fancy Free and the end to the first segment here on Pop Goes the Classics Disney. But stick around. We have two more movies to talk about with Miranda Berthold and Steve Riddle. I am Aaron Diaz. And stick around. We'll be right back.
Don't let my troubles trouble me. Don't cross a bridge or peek round the corner until you're there. Just learn to smile, and in a while you'll find trouble's a bubble of air. Get a happy-go-lucky feeling.
Place Nation, welcome back to Pop Goes the Classic Disney Edition. I am Andy Efton, hanging out with my co-hosts Miranda Berthold and Steve Riddle, and we're still talking about some of these anthology compilation movies, films that came out in the 40s, and we're talking about Melody Time, which came out in 1948, which was the 10th theatrically released animated feature by Walt Disney. And much like the other movies we're talking about, it is similar to Fantasia or Make My Music. This is actually more following in the steps of Saludos Amigos and Fun and Fancy Free, where it's a mixture of animation and live action. So let's just jump into it. So we have the first feature, which is Once Upon a Wintertime, which features Francis Langford singing the title song about two romantic young lovers on a winter's day in the late 1800s. December, named Jenny and Joe. Joe shows off on the ice for his lover Jenny, and near tragedy and a timely rescue ensues. It's intertwined with a similar rabbit couple going through the same things as well. It was released theatrically as an individual short. And then clips from the end of the short showing a horse-drawn sleigh are featured in Disney's very many Merry Christmas songs. So, Miranda, what do you think of Once Upon a Wintertime?
I mean, I thought it was well done. I thought it was cute. It was one of those, like, it's a fun little quick watch. But I don't know if I'd be like, oh, I want to watch that again. Or I want to seek that out, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. No, again, like we've talked about with a few others, it's a beautifully animated piece, mm-hmm. but it's like kind of like, you know, if it's on, I'll watch it, but I'm not going to seek it out kind of thing, you know, but there's nothing wrong with it. Steve, what do you think of Once Upon a Wintertime?
Yeah, kind of echo Miranda. It was fine for what it was. That's just a quick little piece to kind of start the film off, knowing that the more memorable pieces are going to be coming later. So this was just a decent way to start the film.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then we move on to Bumble Boogie. The segment presents a surrealistic battle for a solitary bumblebee as he tries to ward off a visual and musical frenzy. The music is courtesy of Freddie Martin and his orchestra, and is a swing jazz variation of Rimsky-Korsakov's Flight of the Bumblebee, which is also one of the many pieces considered for inclusion in Fantasia. I thought this was fun. You know, it's a short little high-tempo piece. The bee is a perfect choice for the protagonist. Steve, you have any thoughts on Bumble Boogie?
Not really. Just again, nice, quick piece. It would have been interesting to see where it would have fit in Fantasia, mm-hmm. Considering how kind of full that film is. But as it is, it's, you know, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm. All right, Miranda, what about you with Bumble Boogie?
I kind of completely agree. I mean, there are a lot of these that when they're like, we considered this for Fantasia, I would have loved to have seen where they would have placed it to keep, because, you know, Fantasia is very much about, like, the placement of each one of those individual stories. So anytime we've gone through some of these in this segment that we're, or this episode we've done where they're like, oh, we considered this for Fantasia. Mm-hmm. I can see how it would fit, but I would really like to have seen where they would have placed it. And then maybe I would have changed my mind and been like, oh, no, it should have been there instead of here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think they kind of, when we get to their Fantasia 2000, I think they kind of get a chance to do something similar to this mm-hmm. in that one. So looking forward to that. And then we move on to The Legend of Johnny Appleseed, which is a retelling of the story of John Chapman, who spent most of his life roaming Midwestern America, mainly Ohio and Indiana, in the pioneer days, and he was planting apple trees, thus earning his famous nickname. He also spread Christianity. The segment was released independently on Christmas Day in 1955 as Johnny Appleseed, and it has a running time of 17 minutes, making it the second longest piece of this movie. And, you know, the story of Johnny Appleseed was first immortalized around campfires and then later turned into a storybook form. This is Walt's wheelhouse. Walt loved Americana. You can actually find this. I have it on DVD somewhere. It's called Disney Legends, and it's all stories of Johnny Appleseed is on there, Paul Bunyan, mm-hmm. John Henry. So all things that Walt really, really loved. But Miranda, what do you think of The Legend of Johnny Appleseed?
Johnny Appleseed is another one. I hate to keep saying, like, some of these are my favorites, but, like, this is another one of my, when you're talking about Disney animated shorts that I've always really liked. I, too, had that same collection that you're referring to. I had, like, Paul Bunyan and Johnny Appleseed, and I can remember the songs that are on there. And I really loved this one. I thought it was very well done. Very cute. Kind of history in... I don't want to say history because there are some things that we don't know, but clearly with it being like a historical fiction done by Disney, I thought it was really cool because sometimes to teach a child something, the best thing to do is to sit them down and say, watch this. And so I thought it was very well done, and I really liked it.
Yeah, it's legend. It's folklore. It's well animated and, you know, a little sad at the end, but Steve, what did you think of The Legend of Johnny Appleseed?
Yeah, I thought this was a good short. I think most people going in probably knew about who Johnny Appleseed was and knew of his legend, so they kind of had an idea of what to expect, that he was the guy who, you know, went around planting apple trees across the country, and so it was kind of interesting to see it in animated form. I think my favorite part of it was when he's tilling the fields and the animals are unsure of like how to approach him, so they send the skunk after him, and they think he's gonna attack him, but then they see Johnny just kind of petting the skunk and not, you know, being afraid of it, and then they realize that he's, you know, he's a good guy, so they end up befriending him, and they pretty much stay at his side for the rest of his life. So I thought that was kind of cute, and then the big party scene where they're doing the big, you know, doing the dancing and the I guess the early version of bobbing for apples where they mm-hmm. tie it on the string and the people try to bite it. Mm-hmm. And the one guy ends up kissing one of the girls and he gets a slap for it. It was kind of funny. And then all the various apple-based food products they have, just kind of showing out the versatility of the apple. So it was a fun segment. Probably, I think, next to the segment at the end, probably the best-known segment on this mm-hmm. film.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Like I said, it's as we mentioned in the past, edutainment, which you know, it's fun to watch, and also teaches you something about some American folklore. So the next short, Little Toot, it's based on the story of Little Toot by Hardy Gromaski, in which the title protagonist, a small tugboat, wanted to be just like his father, Big Toot, but couldn't seem to stay out of trouble. The Andrews sisters provide the vocals. I thought this was a cute short. It reminded me a lot of Pedro from Salus Amigos with, you know, an anthropomorphized vehicle. I thought there was some funny parts in it, like how could it even possible a ship in the middle of the city, even if it was cartoon physics. You know, I felt bad for his dad. You know, this kid gets him in trouble, and now he has to haul garbage, and then they banish him out to sea where he ends up, you know, saving a ship. But Steve, what did you think of Little Toot?
Yeah, this was a good segment. You know, Little Toot wants to be just like his dad, but he's really just he's pretty much just a adolescent, a disobedient toddler, as I put it in the review. He can't, unfortunately, do anything right. And I will say, kind of harsh that, I mean, granted, you know, he did cause a lot of destruction, but still kind of harsh that they basically sent him out to sea by himself as punishment. But in the end, it works out because he ends up finding the big ship and he leads it back to safety. And he becomes a hero, so it all works out in the end. So, you know, just a cute little segment to keep the film moving.
Yeah, Miranda, what do you think of Little Toot?
I agree. I think it is a perfect like where it's placed here. It keeps everything kind of going and moving. Very cute. Again, like you said, it reminds you of the plane one that we watched earlier, and apparently this short ended up being inspiration for a children's series later called Tugs. Mm-hmm. I'm with you guys. Like, cartoon logic doesn't make sense on some of these parts, but mm-hmm. again, grain of salt, cartoon logic, go with it. But overall, it's very well done, and this is, I think, a good segment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we have a little interlude, Trees, which is a recitation of the 1913 poem Trees by Joyce Kilmer. It's basically just animated scenes through the changing of the seasons. Not much to say about it. Again, one of those, it's a nice, wonderfully animated, beautiful piece, but, you know, it's unless you're watching this movie, I don't know if you necessarily would seek it out. Then we have Blame It on the Samba, where Donald Duck and Jose Carioca meet the Arquian Bird again, who introduces them to the pleasure of the samba. The accompanying music is the 1914 polka, which is fitted from Spanish to English. It's the Paniete Cavino by Ernesto Nazareth. The Dining Sisters provide the vocals, while organist Ethel Smith appears in a live-action role. Kind of like, it reminded me of like a deleted scene from Three Caballeros, basically, mm-hmm. or Los Amigos. But Miranda, do you have anything to say about Blame It on the Samba?
I think it's really well done, and I think if you like the Three Caballeros, or, you know, the three of them together, you definitely should check it out if you've not seen it before. I think it fits well in this and kind of like, kind of provides more of that, people that really liked that, like, oh, here's some more.
Mm-hmm. Steve, did you enjoy Blame It on the Samba?
Yeah, it was good. Nice. It was kind of cool seeing Donald and Jose again. Even though you have to think of the logistics, because in Los Amigos, it's Jose who introduces Donald to the Samba, and yet here they act like Jose is unaware of it, and it's the bird that introduces them to the Samba. Mm-hmm. So kind of weird there. And is it just me, or does it seem like we always have to have a live action actress appearing with Donald? With Donald,
because Donald loves them so much.
I guess, like I said, kind of cool little segment, kind of nice throwback to Saludos Amigos and the Three Caballeros. Kind of weird that Panchito wasn't there, but but for what it was good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then our final segment is Pecos Bill. It's about the Texas famous hero. He was raised by coyotes, similar to how Mowgli was raised by wolves in Jungle Book, and later became the biggest and best cowboy that ever lived. It featured his horse Widowmaker and recounts the ill-fated romance between Bill and a beautiful cowgirl named Slewfoot Sue, whom he falls in love with, love at first sight. The retelling features Roy Rogers, Bob Nolan Trigger, as well as Bobby Driscoll and Luanna Patton, Luanna had appeared in the last movie, which was Fun and Fancy Free. This is a fun, again, it's the Walt's wheelhouse, Americana. There's gunplay, smoking, and, they call the Indians at one point Redskins, which happens to be a no-no, because a whole football team had to change its name. So, Steve, what were your thoughts on Pecos Bill, though?
I thought it was, again, a fun segment, kind of showing off one of the legends of Americana. I thought it was interesting seeing Roy Rogers in it, because I had never seen him in anything before, so it was cool seeing him. Kind of showing off Pecos' life and the over exaggeration of some of his actions, and how he grew up the way he did, and him eventually meeting Sue, and how his horse got jealous of it, so he ended up unintentionally being the cause of what ended up happening to her. And it was a fun segment, kind of like you said, showing off Disney's love of Americana, and it was a nice little close out to this film.
Mm-hmm. All right. Miranda, what are your thoughts on Pecos Bill?
I agree that it was the perfect close out to this film. It just seems to fit really well in with the other segments. I like that you see a lot of Walt in this, that whole like Americana. There was a lot that they decided to completely remove from this, or like cut after the fact. A lot of the smoking, him rolling his own cigarette, which is not uncommon at the time. And even now in certain parts of agriculture, it's not uncommon for someone to roll their own cigarette. They even edited out him fighting with the natives. And so it's strange. It's a very, I want to say it's a very well done one, because I feel like it is. It's that nod to Americana that he loved. It's that nod to Americana that most of us love. But there are parts that were removed. So that's kind of, and I think overall something that we have to consider is a lot of these were kind of told based on the time that you would tell them. So mm-hmm. things are going to be different as we're kind of going through these as well.
Yeah. So, so that wraps up, Melody Time. And now we're going to move on to 1949's The Adventure of Ichabod and Mr. Toad. This is the last of the packaged movies that came out. This is the 11th overall release by Animated Studios. But, you know, coming the next year, we get back to full-length animated features. Actually, we don't see another one until 1977, which we will get to. And the two portions are separate, actually, as televised as part of the Disneyland television series, and then marketed later. I think this is actually the first time I've actually watched this, because I've seen them both numerous times on their own. But this is the first time I think I watched it all together. The first segment is narrated by Basil Rathbone. It's based on The Wind in the Willows, which is a 1908 book by Kenneth Graham, set in and around London, England. The protagonist, J. Thaddeus Toad, Esquire, is introduced as an incurable adventurer who never counted the cost. As the story's one disturbing element, though, he is a wealthy proprietor of Toad Hall Estate. Toad's adventures and positive mania for fads have brought him to the brink of bankruptcy. As a last resort, Toad's friend, Angus McBadger, volunteers as Toad's bookkeeper to help Toad keep his estate, which is a source of pride in the community. So basically, Toad is a philanthropist player, but he's like Tony Stark, you know, but without the Iron Man stuff. And he's kind of like just a fool kind of thing. And he's kind of a jerk, I think. You know, Cyril the horse doesn't seem like a good influence. I really, though, enjoy Badger, the water rat, and Mole. The rat and the mole actually appear in Mickey's Christmas Carol as well. They are the ones collecting for the poor. And Scrooge kind of, shuts the door on them. And then later on when he has his, you know, his epiphany, he, you know, embraces them. The weasels are bad guys. Maybe that's some foreshadowing. And the fact the bartender really takes them for a ride. So, Miranda, what do you think of the Adventures of Mr. Toad, a.k.a. The Wind in the Willows?
I love The Adventures of Mr. Toad. Of course, I love the book The Wind in the Willows, and I felt like this was very well done. I think it's really cute. And just, it kind of really shows, like, how, I'm trying to get it out. My brain is just, like, not producing words. Mm-hmm. So it kind of shows like real concern for friends and real kind of like a change in behavior, and I just thought it was really well done.
Yeah, yeah, it's very British too, because you know
it is
because you know Toad, a Mochica, and Cyril's got hey Governor kind of a voice there, and you know the jailbreak is a lot of fun. That's a good sequence. Steve, what do you think of The Wind in the Willows?
So of the six films we talked about, this one was definitely my favorite of the six, and this was one of the reasons I really enjoyed this. I'd heard of Wind of the Willows, I never read it, but I do remember hearing about it, and I thought this was really well done. I thought the characters were really well done, like the story was good. I always find it funny how they have these like animated films where animals are, you know, alive and can speak and they interact with humans and nobody like raises an eyebrow to it. it's just kind of funny how that always happens. But yeah, it's kind of funny seeing, you know, Toad go through these different manias and his friends are the, you know, unfortunate victims of it, even though, you know, they try to help him and they care about him. And, you know, how we see Toad, you know, sells his own home for a car, and then he gets wrongly accused that it was stolen, and you know, and then the big twist at the end, like you said, the bartender's in league with the weasels, and you know, and they eventually, you know, everything works out in the end. Toad gets Toad Hall back, and you think everything's okay, but then Toad moves on to another mania, and you know, and it's basically the process repeats all over again. But yeah. But it was definitely fun, and I wonder if because I was reading about it, and it said that that Walt had wanted to do a adaptation of The Wind in the Willows since the 30s, and I wonder if there was ever a possibility that he was going to do it as like a standalone and not as part of, mm-hmm. you know, coupled with another short. Mm-hmm. So that would have been kind of interesting to see. But as it was really good.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's fun, and we'll talk about it a little more as we when we do our wrap up talking about the parks. So then the other half is narrated by Bing Crosby, and it is The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, which is a Washington Irving story. Introduces, it's fun. It's Ichabod is a lanky, superstitious yet charming dandy who arrives in Sleepy Hollow, New York, a small village outside of Tarrytown that is renowned for its ghostly hauntings. He is a new schoolmaster. Despite his odd behavior, appearance, and effeminate mannerisms, Ichabod soon wins the heart of the village women and forms good friendships with his students. Brom Bones, the roguish town hero, does his best to bully Ichabod. However, he's not very good at he is very good at ignoring these taunts and continues to interact with the townspeople. One day, Ichabod meets and falls in love with Katrina, the beautiful daughter of wealthy Baltus Van Tassel, and Brom's unofficial fiance. Despite being obsessed with Katrina's beauty, Ichabod merely desires her for her family's money. Himself, Brom, who had never been challenged like this, proceeds to compete with the schoolmaster, but Ichabod wins Katrina over every opportunity. Unpronounced to both men, Katrina is only using Ichabod to make Brom jealous and force him to try harder for her affections. And then it moves on to a Halloween party where, you know, Brahms continues to try to, get one over on Ichabod, and he ends up riding home. He hears the legend, though, of the Headless Horseman, who supposedly travels the woods on Halloween each year, searching for a living head to replace the one he had lost. The only way to escape the ghost is to cross a covered bridge. Everyone else, including Katrina, find the song amusing, while Ichabod starts to fear for his life. And of course, you know what happens. Ichabod is on his way home and comes across the Headless Horseman. And, a chase ensues, and he ends up getting across the bridge. Ichabod's hat is found the next day next to a shattered jack-o'-lantern, but he's nowhere to be found. Sometime later, Brom takes Katrina as his wife. Rumors begin to spread that Ichabod is still alive, married to a wealthy widow in a distant county with all the children who look like him. However, the superstitious people of Sleepy Hollow insist that he has been spirited away by the Headless Horseman. So, Steve, what are your thoughts on The Legend of Sleepy Hollow?
I really enjoyed this, too. I think a lot of people going in probably had known the story of Sleepy Hollow and knew of the legend. It was, probably popular at Halloween parties. And, again, to see, a visual adaptation of it was cool. It's funny, but when I was looking, it's like the name Brom Bones just sounds like a bully's name. And it's like, you expect, you just know he's the, he just looks like what you expect to be, this big brutish guy who thinks he's, the top dog of the town. And this, here comes this lanky, thinly guy who's not trying to start trouble, but the bully just wants to make trouble, and yet he can't. No matter what he does, he can't get the better of him. Ichabod always gets, without realizing it, always gets the better of him, and it is kind of funny that Ichabod is obviously very attracted to Katrina, but yet only wants the family money. So kind of weird, interesting on his part that he's basically just in it for the money. And Brom finally gets him with the story of the Headless Horseman, and then we actually see the Headless Horseman, which is always cool little sight to see. And really good segment. And I think of all the films we've seen of these six, this definitely was the most well-rounded and best produced of the six, because I think instead of it just being a bunch of random segments, they actually went with two fully full-fledged stories and really made them well done.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I quite enjoy this. And the use of sound was really good in this. Ichabod is not the most likable protagonist, basically, in this movie. Brom is such a jerk. I think he's like a precursor to Gaston from Beauty and the Beast. He has a lot. Mm-hmm. I think they drew on that a little bit. I actually grew up not far from Sleepy Hollow in New York. About 20 minutes or so north of where I grew up. So, I mean, we used to go up there for Haunted Hayrides and stuff. And, yeah, It's a nice little town. It's part of Tarrytown, which is just a town that's like right on the water of the Hudson. You cross right. It's right across from like you know, Rockland County in New Jersey. It's a nice area, and it does get spooky up there though. Miranda, what do you think of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow?
I really enjoy this one. This is one I've always really liked. But stories like this in general are things kind of like in my wheelhouse of things that I love. So this is one that has always been like really enjoyable to me. I think it kind of plays into, you know, we've talked a lot in this episode about Walt's love of Americana. And I think this is falling into that again. It's a Sleepy Hollow, and the legend of Sleepy Hollow and the story of the Headless Horseman is definitely a American horror, American, like, scare your kids story. So I think it falls into that for sure. I think it's funny that everyone here is playing the other person for something that they really want. And in the end, I mean, even the Headless Horseman is playing for what he wants. He wants a head. Katrina wants to make Brahm angry. And Ichabod just wants the money. Like, they're all playing each other for something that they really, really want. And I think that leads to, like, life lessons as well. Like, okay, without going too deep into, like, oh, this means this and this means that. But I think it's very well done in a lot of ways, because you could read very deeply into this and you get a lot of life lessons. It's also just a fun, quirky, little scary Halloween story. It's the Americana of things. And then Bing Crosby is a big name, and he narrated this, but he also did the voices of Brahm and Ichabod. So I think that's really cool to kind of get more of Bing and his talent as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To Steve's point about the big names they've gotten in a lot of these compilation movies. Yeah. So in terms of the legacy, they're all, like I said, they're all, you know, fun. You can definitely seek them out if you don't want to sit through watching all the complete movies. They are all available individually on Disney Plus. As far as I know, I think most of them make my music, but definitely all the others, like Ichabod and Mr. Toad, you can watch them together or separately, and a lot of the shorts from Melody Time, Fun and Fantasy Free, and Make My Music. As far as the parks, there's really not much in terms of the first three movies. I believe there's some of them, and we didn't mention on the last episode as well, the Three Caballeros are also featured in Mickey's Feller Magic, which I don't know if you guys have ever been to that. That is one of those 3D, 4D type things where you go in a theater and you put on 3D glasses, and it's kind of like Who's Who of Disney, and it's a journey through kind of like you know, different characters coming in, and Donald is one of the stars, of course, in it. And it's one of those things that it's when you go on it, you get out of the sun kind of thing. And you know, it's actually a 4D attraction. It was Mickey Mouse is a title-bearing character. It's Donald Duck, who's the star of the show, and it's shown on the largest purpose-built 3D screen ever made at 150 feet. I would definitely recommend seeking it out, though. I think you do get wet at one point in the move in the thing. But if you're a fan of Disney animation and 4D rides or attractions, I would highly seek it out. And you'll see them around the parks also at, like, you know, different little spots you may see, or, you know, nods to them. But the biggest one, and it's no longer there in Florida, it's only in California, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. Have either of you ever been on that ride?
I have not.
No?
I think I have, because I remember, because I have visions of the ride with, you know, my dad. And at one point, the weasels pop up and he says, "Watch out for them." So I think I have mm-hmm. been on that ride, but I have very little memory of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's actually kind of scary for little kids, you know, because at one point, like, you go into hell. There's, like, devils in there, and there's I remember going on as a kid, the scene where, like, the train comes at you, and it's just, like, really, it's only, like, the light above your head, but it's kind of scary. So then they got rid of it, and they replaced it with The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh. There isn't an homage to it, though, where you have Toad handing the deed over to Owl. It's you could see it painted on the wall. I can't exactly remember where it was. I remember I did find it. The app lied last time I was in Disney World, and my kids were not happy with me for waiting 45 minutes for Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, because we got out and both of them looked at me and go, that was it. So, but yeah, definitely seek that out. If you are in California, Mr. Toe's Wild Ride is still out there. So check it out. So that's going to bring an end to Pop Goes the Classics. Like I said, this is our last episode talking about these compilation ones. And Miranda, do you want to tell everybody what our next episode will be?
You think it's okay?
Yeah.
I know. Well, I was trying to leave like suspense there. It didn't work out for me this time.
Oh.
Yeah, I could tell them about the next one. So the next one is, like Andy has said, it's going back into the full-length feature films that Disney is well-known for. And our next one is Cinderella.
A great story.
Cinderella.
Yes, we're going to gush over that, especially Miranda. But it's going to be a lot of fun. But, you know, let's kind of, before we go, let's kind of tell everybody what else we have going on here on various podcast feeds, social media. Steve, what do you have to direct people to?
Well, you can find me over at placebnation.com. I have a couple of articles going on there. Of course, my wonderful reviews of Disney, where I'm basically doing the written versions of what we do, where we review the films. I'm closing in on the most recent decade that we've had, of course, the 2010s. So that means we're getting down to the very end. We're getting close to the last couple of films of the canon. It's kind of sad because it's been a fun journey going back and watching all these films. A lot of them I've never seen before, or I had only seen like once or twice. Obviously, a lot of them personal favorites of mine. Kind of going back and watching them, and it's been a lot of fun doing this. It's been a great journey. I also have the Vintage Vault previewing which comes out on the day of the Place to Be podcast, where Scott and Justin are looking at. Are reviewing the class, you know, WWF shows. Basically what I do is I take a match from the show they're watching and I review it myself and kind of give my own little take on it. And then I also have the box office reports, which of course I go back 10 years to the current month and look at the box numbers from that specific month. So around this time should be the newest one, which is October 2010. So good look at that. And that you can, you know, I'm on Facebook if you want to find me there. I'm popping periodically. Other than that, that's pretty much all I got going on.
All right, cool. Miranda, what else do you have going on out there in podcast or social media form?
Social media form, I can always be found over on Instagram, either through Geek and Sassy, Telly and T, or just my personal Instagram, which is linked to both of those. Of course, new episodes of Telly and T and Geek and Sassy coming soon, possibly even more Laugh in Theater, which you can hear me on frequently, usually with Andy, but maybe some new people coming up.
All right. Cool. As for me, you know, yeah, like Maria said, Laugh in Theater is one of my shows, a great debate, Mackie Mount Rushmore and Blockbuster Rewind, all great shows here on the Police Nation Pop feed. Over on the wrestling feed, I have Great Debate Wrestling and Evolution. Also, check out all the great shows on the Police Nation Wrestling Network. Great podcast. Check out The Journey Position, another great podcast feed featuring Geek and Sassy, Talking Pop, The Journey Through Infinity, much, much more, as well as The North South Connection featuring Extreme Three Way Dance, No Holds Barred, Monday Wrestling Warzone. Lots of great stuff. So, this week in the NFL, all fun things going on over there. Also, if you are a person who thinks they know a lot about trivia, we have a game show pod coming soon. We're going to be taping in January. So keep an eye out for a casting call for PTBN Trivia Night. We're going to have themed episodes. And if you win an episode, you make it to the semis. You win the semis, you make it to the finals. And then you will be crowned first ever PTBN Trivia Night Grand Champion. So check out that. So look for us at PlaceNation.com, all on Facebook. We have several pages out there for all the pods and feeds. And, yeah, just keep plugging along and hope everybody's doing well, keeping up with what's going on in the world. But I want to say a big thank you to Steve and Miranda for once again getting together and discussing one of my favorite subjects, Disney movies. And all right, so until then, until the next episode, though, we'll see you and take care, everybody. Bye.